Let's see, we can roll a tape now and get underway here. My name is Bill Miller, and this is the seventh in the series of Finding Balance in a World of Extremes. And the subject today is our faith, our personal religious faith, under the theme Faith, All or Nothing at All, where we'll take a look at the extremes on this dimension, this particular experience of life, and see if we can find a mid-path, a midpoint in between these extremes. Just by way of introduction, the essence of this overall theme, finding balance in a world of extremes, comes out of my observation, as I have dealt with people for many years now, that many of us do live very close to, if not in, the extreme end of various dimensions of life. And over the 10 days that I'm teaching, we're looking at 10 of those experiences of life, and today is the one, the important one of faith. And my thesis is that we can only find the fullness of life that Jesus meant us to have, this perisos, this abundant life that he said, I came you might have. And we can only have this sense of wholeness and completeness, of being a fulfilled person, if we can somehow find a balance in between the extremes. People who live in or close to the extremes do not have an opportunity to grasp this fullness of life. And the odd thing about it is that we don't even realize, many of us, that we're living in or close to an extreme until someone calls it to our attention, until there's a catastrophe or an intervention or something really tragic occurs and our eyes are opened, as we say, and we say, I can't believe that my life has been so lopsided. And so today, excuse me, as we look at the faith dimension, I think we're going to be fooling around with probably one of the most important, if not the most important dimensions, since my understanding is that really all of life is a spiritual experience. My words that I choose are arbitrary for the extremes. I say over-dependence on one extreme all the way down the continuum to its opposite extreme of faithlessness. And some of the concepts or phrases that go with these, a total dependence upon God. I mean total and complete, so that people say things like, God did not want this for me. If I don't get, supposing that I don't follow through on a possibility for a job, you see, because I firmly believe that all of my experience of life is in God's hands, and I don't get the job, I simply say, well, God did not want this for me. Right. Yes, sir?
Question as we go?
Yeah, I've forgotten again. Jeez. Wait, let me say it for the sake of the tape. This is a discuss as we go course. All right. You just wanted to check that out. Okay. Thank you for the reminder. This is another one that is real, real popular in over-dependent types. This has more to do with trying to explain the unexplainable. This is what you hear whenever people have no explanation for a tragedy. And so the over-dependents say, well, it was God's will. You know, some drunken driver runs over your child and kills your child on the spot, and you are just torn apart and distraught, and this person says to you, well, it was God's will, you know, that you're...
But that's a taught theology a lot.
Who teaches that?
How do you hear it all the time?
Yeah, where?
Funerals and everywhere.
I know. Do you hear it from preachers, or do you hear it from people that visit the... You do hear it from preachers that say it was God's will? That's terrible. That's really terrible. And the reason for it is that people... We almost have to have an explanation for things. We can't live with mystery. And if there's no other explanation, those four words, it was God's will, or it is God's will, cover, I mean, that answers everything. Because what are you going to say? How can you respond? Yeah. No, it was not God's will. Oh, I'm sorry, you just don't have enough faith to realize that. And there you are. You know, it's a lose-lose. You can't win. Same with God will provide. God will take care.
Now remember, we're talking about the caricature. We're talking about the extreme here.
Certainly, God will take care of you. You know, what's that hymn? Yes. God will take care of you through every day or all the way. He will take care of you.
Oh yeah, that's right. But not in the absolute, over total dependence sense of it. That's the extreme.
God will show the way.
I don't have to do the searching out. You know, somehow God is going to.
And the words opening doors and closing doors are phrases that the over-dependent oftentimes use. God opens a door for you, God closes the door on you. It's a good thing that God has broad shoulders. I suspect, you know, in anthropomorphic terms, God has very broad shoulders because God can haul all this stuff around that we people put on God. Now, come down to the other end of the spectrum or the continuum, into faithlessness, and you see people who are highly self-sufficient, people who are arrogant. Whenever I mentioned yesterday, last evening to the group that we were going to do this, I said, this is the over-dependent end, and this end is the you sort of attitude, really. It isn't so much the denial of God. That's part of it. You can say, well, that's atheism. That's not really what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking more of people who mock God, make a mockery of God. And last week when I was on the theme of powerlessness and omnipotence, I recited a poem some years back written by Henley. William Ernest Henley, and I want to do that again this morning. I'm repeating myself, I know, but it fits here so beautifully. The arrogant end. Henley had experienced a life-threatening illness or accident or something and really should have died, but didn't. And he wrote, after he recovered, he wrote this poem titled Invictus. And you probably remember it, even if you don't remember the title. And just listen how it seems to fit into this end of self-sufficiency. I don't need anything, I don't need anybody else. I mean, I am it. And he begins, this is a little 16-liner. Out of the night that covers me, black as a pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Doesn't that just kind of get you? I think that's just a marvelous illustration of what I'm saying over here at this extreme. I've come across in my years of working with people, lots of people who shake out at that end. Where they get just I have spent most of my career, a lot of my career as a clinical chaplain working in a large metropolitan hospital. I have seen this much more in men than in women, where serious illness, especially a coronary, will cause these folk to pause just so briefly. However, they will arrange to have their briefcases brought in so that they can continue work in the coronary room. Some will actually deny it. A guy told me one time, I really haven't had a heart attack. It was just some problem with gas. My physician has made a misdiagnosis, but he is young, and so I forgive him for that. And this guy was serious. He wasn't playing games. He truly believed that. So people who claim a kind of spiritual independence, deny any need for benefit of a power beyond themselves. They are quite self-contained. Some of them are really very adamant about it. Guy said to me one time, I came in here to get well, not to have anybody talk to me about religion. And just flopped right over in bed with his head against the wall. And I said, okay, I'm on my way. Very adamant, believe that they are complete unto themselves, are offended actually by the notion that they should have any need of a higher power, whatever that higher power might look like. They oftentimes refer to the spiritual dimension of life as a fantasy, and an opiate, a rationalization to help us through. I don't need any God, thank you, I can do it myself. They to say that they need any strength or support from a supernatural power just flies in the face of their philosophy, and they become very offended by it.
Well, it's easy to understand when you see some of the examples of Christianity around the world and read the history and know
sure.
the part that religion has played, and look at the Jimmy Swaggerts and the
sure.
James Watts, and for that matter, and mm-hmm. a lot of other people that you might have a hard time relating to that claim, make a strong claim.
I know. My response is, you're absolutely right, but I would add, look at all the crooks in high finance, and we still play the stock market, and we still invest in bonds, don't we? Yeah. So there's just something a little different about this spiritual dimension. That and that difference is what makes us absolutely sure that we are, all of us, spiritual beings with the image of God in us, because nothing else quite upsets us as much as this dimension. I mean that. You can go on and talk about all of the swindling that's gone on in the last couple years in high finance. And I hear it. I mean, I'm in Minneapolis. There's a lot of things going on there. And the kind of cute maneuverings, you from Minneapolis know how our governor has abandoned any contact with a prime figure in the Midwest federal scandal. That's cute. And still, despite all of that, you know, I don't hear people saying, high finance is rotten. It sucks. It's full of just rats. Therefore, I will have nothing to do with high finance. No, I don't hear that. See, I saw a hand. Yes, sir.
Well, and another thought that's going through my mind as you're saying that, and that is, there, on one hand, we're talking about someplace in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's almost an unattainable position. It's like having two magnets. You know, you have a positive and a negative, but we're saying, no, we're not going to be attracted to the positive
yeah.
or the negative.
Yeah.
We're going to try and stand that no man's land in the middle.
No person's land.
No.
See what's happened to me? I've only been here for 9 days and I got it already. But listen.
But please do not detract from my statement.
But that's what we are about here. What you're saying is exactly what we are about, trying to pull these opposites together and find a midpoint. Recognize that there's good stuff and bad stuff over here, and there's good stuff and bad stuff over here. Without falling in the trap of deciding that one extreme is desirable, if you will, and the other extreme is undesirable. That's what we oftentimes do in the organized church. And my point is, as I've said in every session, I'll say it again now, we always look for that which is desirable in the midst of that which appears to be across the board undesirable.
Well, but what made me think of that is the fact that you never, the people that attain that midpoint, that
yeah.
area in the
yeah.
middle, you never read about them.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
It's the extremes.
That's
that
right.
Get
it's the common
the
person.
Headlines, the extremes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get in the paper.
Sure. Oh, sure.
That are on TV. We never hear about.
This is
the
true.
People that attain that balance.
Yeah, that
midpoint.
Have, right. That.
But we have neighbors, and we associate with people that...
Okay, but...
Yeah.
Is, you know,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, at the other extreme here is what I would call religious fanatics. Fanatics are usually very highly prejudiced, and they're very, very judgmental. These people who are... sort of congregate down on the over-dependent end are very narrow people, and are quite judgmental of other people who are not where they are, thank you. In grieving situations that I alluded to earlier, if they don't say it outrightly, they do it in a very covert way. If you only had more faith, like I do, you wouldn't be all bent out of shape by this, as you are. they have a really unhealthy and, I would say, an unbiblical dependence upon faith that is expressed in statements like these, or similarly, I am completely helpless in this situation. There's nothing I can do about it. It is all in God's hands. God will take care of it. This experience in which I find myself can only be resolved by God, and I am powerless. Every once in a while, I run into that in a counseling situation where a person has no sense of any personal responsibility for his or her life. And I can do nothing to help them move towards the resolution of whatever the issue is until I can help them realize that it's a two-way street. God indeed is a great help and support to us, but we have to get off our duffs and go to work on what we perceive is the route to go towards some kind of resolution.
I would suggest these people are judgmental toward themselves as well, not just toward them.
Yeah, what oftentimes I have discovered, and people will rebel against this quite vociferously, is that anybody who appears over on this end, no, I shouldn't say that. Most of the time, people who appear over on this end are really very wobbly in their faith underneath, and are compelled, oftentimes because of external messages, to stay in that posture. And sometimes when a big catastrophe comes in, it knocks those pins out. And all of the old cliches that these things represent, these euphemisms, they don't hold up. And people literally go to pieces and end up with emotional breakdown. And very, very serious ones at that. Yes?
Would that also include a very literal interpretation of the Bible?
Yes.
Because if you lose one little part of the Bible, you've lost it all.
Right. And that is why I say, at least in my experience, many of these people have to really come on very strongly, like gangbusters, and pound their point to make it. There's an old story about the church custodian who got in and was vacuuming up in the chancel area, the carpet up in there, and he got just stepped into the pulpit, turned the vacuum off and stepped into the pulpit on Monday morning, you know, and he just noticed that the preacher's notes of the previous day were still in there. And so he starts right in, and he's up there preaching to this empty church, reading off the guy's notes, you know, and he turns the page, and all of a sudden he sees something in red written in the margin. He looks down and it says, "Argument weak here. Pound pulpit extra hard." So that, you know, when your argument gets a little wobbly, if you can come on a little stronger, why, you might be able to get it through. I like that one.
You've given us some words for each of the extremes. Mm-hmm. What would be some description for the middle portion, for the midline? What would be some words that you would lend to them?
Oh, gee whiz. Can you hold off?
Sure.
I want to get into what I'm calling intradependence and extradependence. And I think that may help. If it doesn't, wave the flag again when we get there. We depend upon a multitude of spiritual resources that are available to us to enhance our spiritual dimension, and we're going to take a quick look at those a little later on. But we still make responsible choices, you see. We have to recognize this gift of freedom of will that God gives to us. It's probably the finest blessing that we have. If we didn't have that, we would be robots. That freedom of will is a marvelous gift. And that gift carries with it the expectation that it shall indeed be used. that we shall use the power of making choices. We have, and I have to come down kind of heavy on this, we have so much more control of our destiny than we like to think that we do, that it sometimes frightens me. If we just stop to think that God gives us, and sometimes I think God is crazy for doing it, but nevertheless, God continues to do it, to give over to us the power to select and make choices, and truly to shape our destinies. We are not leaves tossed around by the October winds. We are not victims of fate or circumstance. We have choices, and we have power to shape our destinies. We're not certainly like Henley in the poem Invictus. I don't. That's all the way down there, like, you know, I can control everything. No, not that. But it's very clear that in the New Testament, to live the way Jesus would like us to live is a very, very, very difficult task. You just can't read the Gospels and walk away and say, hey, you know, piece of cake, no sweat. Not at all. You can't do that. It's just overwhelming how very, very difficult it is. And still we are called to do just that. And Jesus makes a big point out of it. But the thing is that God is really very faithful, and God promises to support us in our living. God absolutely does not live our lives for us. Never has. Oftentimes, God puts out what he would like for us to do, and we say, no, thank you. Thank you, but no, thank you. And we go our own way, and sometimes we have great regrets for it. Sometimes people really struggle against what they know is clearly what they need to be doing. But God does not live our lives for us. You walk the way I want you to go, he says, which I have clearly identified to you, and I will support you. But you still have to do it. The process is, what is intriguing you right here with all the little kids running around, is to observe what I call these words, the intradependence and the extradependence. Little kids in the process of maturation like very much to be independent, want to be away from mama and daddy. And you see them, they'll go out and they'll climb the sand pile and roll a stone down or something and be on their way. Just last night, where the dickens was it now? Oh, I know, it was before before Vespers started. There was a little kid up pretending, playing the piano, just being, and father was saying, come on over, sit down. No, and he's dinking around there, and slipped and banged his head against the against the low end of the register. Did any of you see this? He didn't get hurt badly, but boy, right over to daddy, right up in the lap, and oh, my head. Kids, when they're learning to walk, they want to be very independent. But if they flop down, start to cry, and look over to mama or daddy, or they want to go over and mess around with the pussycat, the cat's fine, now be careful. Yank Tabby's tail once or twice too often, and Tabby turns around and goes, shh, like cats are wont to do, and wow, right back over now to mama or daddy because their safety has been threatened by the pussycat. Now you see the interweaving of the intradependence. Intra means within. Extra means without. And so we go through life as having this power, this ability within us, and our want to be dependent without any help from anywhere else. And there come moments whenever we realize that, hey, this is much too risky. And so we run to the extra dependence. And I think that this is largely the way we develop in our spiritual lives, having the balance between those two. I go back and looking, now some of you know, as I mentioned earlier, that I spent a quarter of a century as a clinical chaplain in a hospital. Through my training and my education and my experience, I had developed a good sense of ability and capability. This is a fascinating job because you never know from one minute to the next what you're going to run into. in a critical setting. And so I have a sense of intradependence. I have education, I have basic wisdom, and I have experience. And that allows me to have a sense of confidence as I go into these critical situations. But from time to time, I go into the chapel and sit down quietly by myself and just communicate with God, asking for wisdom, asking for support, asking for the ability to make the right choice in the next situation that I encounter. That's the extra dependence. Many of us in the process of growing up, particularly those of us who come out of a not too swift childhood, for whatever reason, lean much more heavily on the independent side, on the intradependence. And oftentimes resist wanting to reach out for help and say, I need, there's not everything that I can do myself. Yes, I am a force. I am a source. I am a resource within myself. No question about it. I am intradependent. But then again, I know that I have a greater force, a greater source, a greater resource beyond myself, which is nevertheless very close to me. Very, very close to me. I like to consider it as close as my very own breath, taking from the pneuma, the spirit, that God is as close as my very own breath, and that this balance of extra dependence and intradependence is what will lead me into the abundant life, the sense of wholeness and completeness, and will help me into this mid-path, which, as you rightly say, is sometimes very difficult to find. Okay, let me check with you and see if that sets okay, that business of the intradependence and the extradependence. Sometimes people rather casually put it into the phrase, God helps those who help themselves. I don't know if that's accurate. It certainly isn't biblical. I mean, you won't find it in the Bible anywhere. But there certainly is some sort of tilted truth to that. But my way of saying it is that I am dependent upon the powers that I have, but I go beyond myself and tap the resources of the Almighty, yes.
I think about some of my own background in organizations like Young Life.
Yeah.
Even the Presbyterian Church, of which I am a member, but each Presbyterian Church seems to have a little more Calvinism than the other.
Yeah.
But I think of how even within mainline Christianity, how this whole idea of free will and what you're talking about, intra and extra dependence, really does vary within each denomination and, of course, within each person or congregation.
Right, even within each congregation. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And oftentimes some of these problems in relating to one another come about because of those variations within a congregation. Anything else?
Question.
Yes, sir.
For you, in your profession, on one hand, many people don't think of it as having the potential of maybe becoming an ego trip.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when what you're doing in your job, in your role, particularly in a clinical situation where you deal with a lot of people that all of a sudden their whole world is just absolutely turned upside down and destroyed. What's your reference point? How do you know? Or how do you prevent sliding into that feeling of, I have the answers, they rely on me, almost sliding into a role where you become your own God?
Know exactly what you mean.
Do you have precisely to have something that you can grab a hold of and say, wait a minute, I'm straying from the middle ground where I want to be, to where, yes, I am fulfilling a role, And I serve a purpose for these people, but I can't get to where I believe it too much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Sure.
And to step back over and say, whoa, wait a minute. I'm mm-hmm. still just a tool of the good Lord.
Right.
How do you maintain that middle ground? I'm asking you personally.
There are three things that pop into my head, and I'll recite them for you so that I don't forget. And then I'll go back and elaborate on them. The first is Scripture itself. The second is self-knowledge and self-understanding. And the third are colleagues. First of all, just in private meditation, I'm a little later this morning, I want to look at a good dozen sources of input for the spiritual dimension of our lives. But in simply reading Scripture in a balanced way, you've got a good governor on you to tell you that indeed you are I am the apple of God's eye. But let's not forget, Bill, that there are a lot of things that God has expected of you that are clearly identified no matter where you read the Scriptures, and you ain't getting them off. You just ain't getting them off. No matter how effective, efficient you are missing the mark. Hamartia, that good old image of sin. And so just a meditative and scripture reading life will help a person who is honest about going after it to keep a sense of balance. Now I have to add that because that ties into the second dimension, knowing and understanding myself. I have become a firm believer in heightening our awareness about ourselves. Sometimes people say, why do you want to learn all this stuff about yourself? You know, why make your life so complicated? When I grew up, my mother said, ignorance is bliss, and I believe that's right. You know? Look at the old Laurel and Hardy cartoons. You know, they kind of go bopping through life. Nothing there. They made it. You know, they didn't have all this kind of internal analysis and all that sort of stuff. Why do you want to go messing around inside your psyche anyway? You know, just forget it. Well, that's all well and good. But the problem with it is that the less I know about myself, the less control I have over myself, the less power I have. And the more power has my unconscious psyche, which oftentimes will move me where I don't want to go. And that's always my big argument for self-understanding and self-awareness. The more I know about myself, the more I can be in charge of my life. Do you want to speak to that one specifically?
Just quickly, yeah. For me, the more I understand about myself, the easier it is to relate and understand to other people.
But yeah.
That's always kind of a mystery to me because I'm such a mystery to myself. But I think, for instance, the more I understand how scared I am in certain situations, the more I can understand other people being scared or whatever.
Sure.
Whatever the feeling may be.
So that helps me. I talk to myself a lot. Not in public, but because I know what happens if you do that. You become the one ministered unto rather than the one doing the ministry. But I do. I talk to myself a lot. And have developed a pretty strong sense of humor over the years of not taking myself too seriously. I think that's a very important, for me, it's a very important factor in my life. And the third one I mentioned to you is the presence of colleagues. If you have an opportunity to be working in a setting where people are open and free with one another, you can check out, so to speak, how you're appearing. Or a colleague or an associate will say to you, have you noticed lately that you're doing this, that, or the other thing? And in the confidentiality of a clinical setting where you can share situations, and we really have to do that, we who work intimately with people in their lives, with anonymity, receive from a colleague just a reflection on your role of how you are dealing with a person. Not necessarily that one is supervising the other, but that we are sharing our insights Because many times we can't see what we are into. Many times we can be sliding in the direction you're talking about, up to that arrogant end, and not even realize it. That's my whole point. But having a setting where there are colleagues who will mutually give feedback to one another in a constructive, creative way, that's a real blessing. So there are indeed certain ways, if indeed you want to do it. That's the bottom line. Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask you about the word arrogant on the right side. Actually, I'm having trouble with the continue.
Okay.
I feel like it ought to go
further.
Way down on the right.
Okay.
To angry, anarchistic, nihilistic. What's going on in which people are just hopelessly.
Okay. We fooled around with that last week in the personal power one.
I have trouble with this arrogance because, as far as faith, this is the subject. The people on that end seem to be very arrogant.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so,
you're right. You're
so
right.
We have a situation where I lived this past spring where on Earth Day, three of the major fundamentalist churches on the island. Essentially, struck out against Earth Day things going on in the school system. Very modest things that were designed to raise consciousness. And reduced it to slander, incredibly arrogant. But the people are basically on that over-dependent side. And so the people of faith, or of a struggling faith, we're trying to find out that middle ground. This is what you were saying, Kevin. Wait, I don't want any. I don't.
Yeah.
Where is there a middle? Or just fall back into this thing that, to me, takes the faithlessness to the center rather than to the left. So I don't want to change the focus of the discussion.
Yeah.
And change your assumption.
No.
It just seems to me. Be the problem for me in faith, that reaction to the people who are over dependent.
Yeah. No, I can move right along with you on that. A little bit of the arrogance on this end is what I was trying to say whenever the people come on like gangbusters. That's apparently what the folk did on your island there. Came on real hard, real strong,
right.
and shouting, you know, their wobbly position. That's why I say, if you're ever able to peel off that layer of steamrolling and bulldozing and look underneath, you see people who are really pretty wobbly. However, they are generally in the midst of enough people around them to keep reinforcing them and shoring them up, and they do this to each other and keep building it. Yeah, I don't know about the continuum, the spectrum, if it's accurate or not. I think all I'm just trying to say is that we do have these extremes, however we might voice them, and somehow we struggle to find a mid-path that says that there is definitely something of value over on this end to be used moderately, and certainly something of value over on this end to be used moderately also.
In the middle there's kind of a guilt-producing kind of feel.
Oh, really?
It says, well, I think if you don't have faith, do you have faith? Or why don't you have faith?
Let's see how we're doing. Time-wise, we're going to be able to get to some of the real supports of faith, and it's going to turn out that doubt is one of them. All right. Let's hustle on then and see what we can get through here. I'm going to have to throw some of this stuff away. Trust is a very powerful thing. To trust that outside source, God, is going to help me, that extra dependence is going to shore up my intradependence. That is a very powerful thing, to have that assurance, to have that confidence, which again in Scripture comes through to us very clearly time and time and time again. I am with you always, he says. That's an absolute. I am with you always. Trust is a very powerful thing, but it's also very risky to put your trust that heavily into the extra dependency of your life. You want to say, I don't know if I want to do that. I think I want to go much more on my own. I know me. I mean, I know what I can do and can't do. That's a pretty clear thing. I took a passage out of the Sermon on the Mount, recognizing that people then had essentially the same kind of situation that we have today. I do believe, obviously, that given the age, the circumstances are somewhat different, but still, they faced up to an awful lot of what we face up to with different externals, because he says to them, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Isn't life more important than food and the body more important than clothes? And then he says, look at the birds of the air. They don't sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Who of you, by worrying, can add one single hour to his or her life? Obviously, you can't. And why do you worry about clothes? He says, see how the lilies of the field grow. They don't labor or spin, yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and gone tomorrow, thrown in the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear? The pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. Seek first his kingdom, his dominion, and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own.
Well, we've certainly taken that to heart.
Isn't that the truth?
I mean, that's why we're in a mess with the economic system. It's time, short term.
Yeah. We have never, as I understand it, in our history, in our economic history, been at a lower point of productivity than the United States of America. Yeah.
I appreciate the examples and stories that you have given throughout your discussions, and I just have a real quick one that I'd like to share.
Sure.
I have found faith as a fantastic adventure in trusting him. For instance, I'm a first grade teacher, and mm-hmm. I taught up in a small rural community in Browerville, which has 500 people. Being a mm-hmm. single person, I found after 3 years of teaching that I needed a change. So I packed up and I went to Minneapolis, and I applied to all the schools. I was going to sub, and then one day I got a phone call from a principal asking if I would come in for an interview. At the end of the week, I was offered the job. So that, you know, and I had other jobs behind. I was waitressing. I've done that through college to get through. Mm-hmm. But it was. My parents were wondering, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And the people, colleagues and friends were saying, you have a job, you have your benefits. Mm-hmm. But it's just like, I knew myself mm-hmm. that I needed a change.
Yeah, it's risky.
It is.
Do you remember the, I bet some of you do, in the days of the Encounter Group in the 60s when we used to do these things called a trust fall?
Yes.
How many of you know what a trust fall is?
Oh, yeah.
Some of you, for those of you who don't, what you would do, and its purpose was to demonstrate trust, you would just make your body pretty rigid, and you put your hands on your hips in order to leave a space here. And you would have a friend or a colleague whom you trusted standing behind you, and you would just make your body as stiff as you could and let yourself go back like that, and hoping and expecting that the person would catch you under the armpits and slowly lower you down. I mean, you know, the person could just walk away and say, hi there. And so you really did. You really did put your trust in that person. You would say to yourself, now he or she is not going to let me fall on the floor.
But nothing in this world is absolute. You don't know for sure, for absolutely sure. And what if he suddenly gets a cramp in his arm or her arm or something like that, you know?
But that struck me as being a marvelous illustration of the riskiness of trust. That if we are going to trust, it really is a risk. One of the famous stories of Soren Kierkegaard was the leap of faith story of the deer who finds itself up against a wall suddenly. This is a rather intelligent deer, you have to understand this. But anyway, begins sniffing along and continues on around along the wall on and on for a couple days, and then all of a sudden realizes that he or she has passed this area before, that this is familiar turf. And logically concludes that this must be a giant circle. And I'm either on the inside or the outside. I don't know what's on the other side of the wall. And so Kierkegaard says, what the deer does is trots on back quite a distance and puts it into high gear and trots and gallops and takes a giant leap up over the wall, and that's the end of the story. And you don't know if, you know, the deer goes into oblivion or if the deer finds paradise or what. And he says that's the leap of faith. You have absolutely no assurance. Well, you say you've got the Bible. Well, okay, so maybe the Bible is phony. You know, maybe the whole works is just a story. You have absolutely no concrete assurance. That is the riskiness of trust. Yeah.
How is trust different from disposition God will provide?
Trust uses the intra as well as the extra. This is kind of like blind faith. And we don't ever see in the Gospels Jesus calling for blind faith. Does that make any sense at all?
Well, in the passage that you read about, you know, not, don't worry about what you're
right.
aware.
Right.
The ways of the field.
Right.
To me, that is very close to blind faith.
Go about your, just like you were saying in your story. You left your job. You had nothing to go to. But whenever you got to Minneapolis, you didn't just sit on the curb somewhere saying, you know, there's going to be a job pop out of the sky.
She struggled with the choice and the decision.
And she went after. She went after doing something with no guarantee. No, you know, it was a leap of faith. That was a real leap of faith. But it's different from the blind faith, which would say, well, here I am, God, now, you know, send the job to me. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a blatant illustration. That's a blatant example, maybe a caricature. And yet people oftentimes do that.
Does God help those who don't help themselves?
I don't know.
He will if he wants to.
I really don't know. That's a difficult one to answer. That is to know the mind of God. Does God save those who spit in his face? I don't know. You know, it seems clear from Scripture that we have a hand in it, but I'm happy that I don't have to be the one that makes that decision. Really, it's a hard question. Very hard.
Is the
answer?
Oh. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just was thinking of people who come to me and they say, oh, you're a Christian, and so I prayed to God and gave him my shopping list of entries, and so I know it's all going to be taken care of, and I always feel like, that's nice. That's really overdependence. The other point I want to make real quick is, you know, Kushner's viewpoint, what I think it to be, is where, you know, God is a loving, caring person. He didn't destine your child to be killed by an alcoholic, but he, you know, God will give you the strength to go through, allow you the grieving process, and maybe come to a positive end to your grief as opposed to a negative end or a bitter end. And so at times I want to go, yes, God does give us choices, and he does make you to be responsible, as opposed to saying, well, if I pray hard enough, my problems will go away.
Right.
You know, and these people look at me, and I have this happen in our small community. They go, oh, you're a Christian. Then you know all I have to do is pray. Would you please pray that we make the mortgage payment this month?
You know, is that right?
Well, yes. I have one neighbor who said our roof was repaired because we prayed to God.
Yeah.
And God must have seen, you know, and he was up there playing checkers with us, and he moved the right piece in, and the money came down, and we got the roof fixed. And we're just so grateful. And, you know, I'm glad we got the roof fixed. But you don't really think God was up there with the checkerboard,
right,
moving the pieces and lining.
That's a good illustration of this end down here. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I've always had a lot of trouble with that because of that dichotomy with that Bible verse that you just read about the problem of being dependent or being independent and controlling your own destiny and so on. And anyway, the negative aspect of that really gets to me. The first thing that came into my mind was the national debt. Mm. You know, people tend to say it's going to be okay. I mean, we are in our country. We have always done this because we've had so much.
Right.
We've had so many natural resources, and the whole ecological thing is the same thing. You know, we have shirked responsibility, and now we're leaving to our children a debt that's beyond any of our imaginations. And we also have created an environment that really threatens our futures, and yet we're still, even though we're trying, obviously we're trying, but there's still a whole lot of folks out there that are in denial.
What your comment
on that as regards
the
Bible verse. About
okay, what you're pointing up is irresponsibility, the irresponsibility of freedom.
And I think it's brought on by the quote about, you know, trust in God, he's going to take care of it. And we've always done that, you know, throw the garbage out the window, pollute the rivers, whatever, you know, pollute the ocean, kill all the fish with the nets. I sound like a radical here.
Go.
Always trust him. He'll take care of it.
You're pointing up the flaw that in among sinful people always comes into play with liberty and freedom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The difference.
You cannot have liberty and freedom without resultant and corresponding responsibility. Well, I take that back. You can have, but when you have it, you have what we have now.
We still have to be responsible.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So
and that's why I say, and kind of facetiously said earlier, maybe God is crazy for continuing to give us a freedom of will. Because
so the opposite end with the communist society or whatever, where the people are totally controlled.
Yeah.
You know, the comfort of letting somebody else make all the decisions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's real hard to be independent.
Right. You remember after Vatican II, the great distress in the Roman Catholic Church about why are you giving us all this freedom? We don't understand this. We don't know what to do. Oftentimes, when you don't know, when you're not aware, your awareness isn't heightened to other possibilities, you live in that and say, this is the norm. And that, I think, is tragic. I don't think it is. I know full well it is. Yes.
Doesn't that scripture say have no anxiety about tomorrow? Mm-hmm. I don't think that necessarily implies don't plan for tomorrow, don't take responsibility.
Oh no, doesn't say that at all.
I think that's a mistake.
No, it very clearly says don't sit around, you know, wringing your hands and saying, oh, what are we going to have to eat? While instead of being out planting, you're sitting there saying, oh, what are we going to have to eat? Or working to earn money to buy clothes, say, oh, I'm going to go naked. Yes.
A lot of trouble with that passage because of these very reasons about responsibility, because I think a lot of people have a lot of faith and they try really hard and they don't have any clothes and they don't have a place to live, and then I think a lot of people then say, well, you don't have faith, or if you just trusted, or if you just prayed more. And I think that passage is often really misused.
It can be. It certainly can be.
A lot of people have a lot of faith and work really hard, and
it certainly can be. If any of you have ever had any doings or dealings with the 12-step program, you know Niebuhr's Serenity Prayer. And that helps me in all of this. The whole one, not the brief one, but the full one that goes, and this is, again, easier said than done, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as a pathway to peace, taking, as Jesus did, the sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that you will make all things right if I surrender to your will, so that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. Now you can say, well, in a way, that's kind of idealistic, isn't it? Maybe it is, I don't know. But it certainly does seem to help me through the miseries of life, as it so often appears to be, and to recognize that in the midst of all of that, there is great joy, and there is the potential of this abundant life. Yes?
Well, just one thought, and sitting here listening to some of the discussion, I think one of the things that I know now myself as well, it has a problem in that, on one hand, I think you're approaching, and I might be wrong, but I'm seeing you focusing this discussion on dealing with the extremes and finding a middle ground individually,
mm-hmm.
and dealing strictly with our own person, if you will, and ignoring the same thing when you add to it politics, if you will, or the interaction of many bodies in a community, in a church, in a state, county, or country. Are you attempting to address the same question as a group of people at the same time here, or are you dealing primarily with just sort this out individually?
It would certainly be applicable to a whole group, to a whole nation, to the whole world of humanity as far as that goes. But I found the effective way to deal with any issue like this is one-on-one. And so I gear virtually everything I'm saying to individual persons, because individual persons, if they are, so to speak, converted to a midpoint, will automatically bring the mass to a midpoint. It's kind of tough because of the uniqueness and the diversity of people. That's one thing that I teach my students as counselors, that there are very, very few absolutes in dealing with people, and that I have to meet you where you are, and I have to meet you where you are. And maybe the best way to deal with your issue is to be pretty strong and confrontive. Maybe the best way to deal with you and your issue is to be very supportive and walking along with. And that's the genius of the one-on-one. But obviously that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, and isn't as easily done as trying to convert the mass, so to speak. But ultimately, what I'm saying is applicable to the whole thing, I believe. But I'm gearing it mostly personally, yeah. Yes, sir?
Another facet of the same question is, if you're living in a system that's on one extreme, it's awfully difficult for the individual to get...
Yeah, oh yeah.
You're pulled over to that side.
To break up a pattern. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is.
Well, we've certainly seen, and I've lived in California, and that's the state that bounces from one extreme
yes.
to the other. You know, it's always a reaction yes. to the other extreme. They just can't seem to
yeah.
get together in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, I lived there during the Jerry Brown, Pat Brown
yeah.
Era of liberalism, and
right.
Ronald Reagan comes
right.
along and saves the state, and you go boom, boom,
right.
boom.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is what you look like after you go boom.
Well, I said
I boomed up to Seattle. Which is, you know, our state, talking about polarization, this is one of the greatest polarized states in the whole United States.
Washington State?
You betcha.
Is it? For
well, look in the last election, you know, the only state to vote for Pat Robertson, yet we barely supportive of Dukakis.
Yeah.
It's a very polarized state.
Real quickly, I had already. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's all, are you telling us that to achieve the balance, we have to rely on the inner side of us as well as look at the outer side of us? Is that the God within us and the God without us?
Mm-hmm.
And then is there another part of that? There's a part that I'm missing. Is there the God above us?
Well, the God outside of us, yeah.
That's the God without. Yeah. Where's the God within? Where's the God above?
That's the God without, outside.
So they're both the same.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There are three sides to that?
I don't think so. No, it's God and me, and me and God. And we got to be in cahoots together. And being in cahoots together, we can win. That's I was going to say that there are three dimensions yet that are great supporters to the faith, and that is the doubt, and that is forgiveness, and that is hope, those three. Try never let anybody talk you out of your doubt. Doubts are wonderful things, and they are necessary to have. People had them all through the New Testament. You go all the way up to when Jesus ascends into heaven. And he calls the 11 remaining disciples, you know, these guys up to the hillside there in Bethany outside of Jerusalem. And Matthew says, and they came, but some doubted. some of them were still doubting about this whole thing right when they're on the hill saying bye-bye to Jesus. We have doubts, there's no question, and God knows that. And to confess our doubts to ourselves, even to talk with him about some other people. You know, the interchanges that we have here, I would be amazed if everybody left saying, absolutely, I agree with everything you've said, Bill. That's not where it is. We have our doubts, we have our questions, and that's a part of the faith. Any of you who know anything about scopes in clinical settings, you know if there's a straight line on the scope, what that means, you are one dead cookie. We've got to have our ups and our downs. That's the way, that's the normalcy of the spiritual life.
Watch that word, Bill.
Pardon?
Okay. Watch that word, Bill. Normal.
Oh, normal. Oh, my good cousin, normal, yeah. And, oh, yes.
Just the thought, you know, your comment about doubts.
Mm-hmm.
If the doubts disappear, can that be a clue that you have slid to one extreme or the other? That the pendulum is no longer trying to stay in the middle? That it has
no. More often than not, it is an internal resolution that has taken place. Oftentimes, and this you may not believe this, but that's okay.
Doubt disappears.
Yeah.
You no longer have doubt.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
A
it's a clue that the thing has resolved itself within you. That somehow it has been resolved in a way that you don't even realize. Maybe it was through talking with somebody. Maybe it was through something you read in the Bible or some piece of religious literature or looking at a stained glass window. God only knows what it is. There's all kinds of things that happen to us. But whenever the doubt is no longer a doubt and you can't say, I don't know how come it's no doubt any longer, all you need to know is that it has been resolved within you and you have grown ever so little, much more, closer towards a healthy spiritual life. It's a great sign.
Or should it be an apathy, do you think? Or I don't understand.
No, I think you know the difference between a resolution and apathy. Apathy, you're pretty conscious of. You say, well, the heck with that. I'm not going to fret myself about that anymore. The concept of forgiveness and the concept of hope, the concept of forgiveness, just, I mean, when we're talking about the Good Friday and the Easter morning thing, what that does for us is clearly tells us the great value and worth we have in the eyes of God. I mean, that's, I don't think that God goes around sacrificing himself for worthless critters. No, indeed. There is great love and great empathy for us in our struggles, which allows us to have hope. Hope that you just don't find in people of non-faith. I'm here to make that witness and that testimony because I've dealt with thousands of people on both sides of the fence, and I want to tell you, in critical times, there is hope no matter what. The ultimate hope is that even if I don't make it, whatever the it is in this life, I have the gift of life everlasting. And that's a very, very powerful part of the midpoint. Not something that we boast about on the one extreme, not something that we say, well, maybe yes, maybe no on the other, but knowing